Well, happy new year to y'all, huh? New year, yeah. So I'm excited for a new year, and this is just—it's always exciting because you know, I get to look forward to a new year of messages. We've already got our next series planned out, which is going to be called "When Life Sucks Everything Out of You." And so maybe some of you are like, "Okay, I think I'm interested already." You piqued my interest. But yeah, there are some things that suck the life out of us, and you know, my hope is that those things will not suck the life out of you this coming year. And so that's what we're going to start off next week. But this week is one of my favorite Sundays of the year because I get to go back and basically I'm going to preach you 52 messages in one, in a half hour or less. I think last service was like 33 minutes. So, but we kind of go back and revisit the stuff from last year, and I also like it because to prep for this message, I have to go through and listen to a bunch of messages from last year. And it's kind of a weird thing. I really kind of actually like listening to myself preach. Don't. And it's not for the vanity reasons that you're thinking. It's because it's like I'm hearing myself say stuff, and I can't argue with the guy talking. You know what I mean? It's like I can't be like, "Oh, that guy didn't know what he's talking about." No, it's like I remember those thoughts, and I remember where those came from. And I remember the biblical passages that I was studying that brings those things back, and it's almost like a very clear memory jog as I'm going back and listening to stuff, and I can almost, it's really funny, I can even predict what I'm going to say next. That's kind of a really cool thing. So, but listening to those things, it's also quite neat is, you know, sometimes some of the things that are, some of the messages from last year are things that I've forgotten, and there are things that, you know, I've lost sight of, and it was really good to refocus back in, and so I want to encourage you, maybe if there's just some topic or idea that piques your interest from last year, they're on the website. You can go back there and just re-listen to them. If there's some thing that you're going through right now that you need to kind of revisit, go back and revisit those things. Maybe the life sucks everything out of you is really not what you're dealing with right now. Maybe it's something with family and relationships or about a refresh on your life, and you can go back and listen to those series. And so we started off last year, and it's really hard to believe that it was just a year ago. It was 1 year ago this week that I really came back on staff full time. I had been on a sabbatical. I sort of came in and just preached some Christmas messages, but it was really January is when I came back on staff. For those of you who don't know, my wife passed away in the summer of 2012, and so I just really took some time away, and I spent those 6 months kind of reflecting on life and on the Bible and everything else that I've learned. And when I came back in, I preached a series called Perspective. And so this was the bumper video from that series. And then we'll look at the topic and what we covered. I'd spent most of those 6 months that I took off really going through and contemplating the life of Job. For those of you who don't know about Job, Job is a book in the Bible about a guy named Job. And it's actually considered to be the earliest book in the Bible, like one of the first books. You know, it's one of the earliest stories from the Bible. And Job is a guy who God's bragging on, and Satan's like, he only loves you because you give him all this good stuff. If he didn't have all these good things in his life, he'd curse you to your face and walk away. And God's like, no, it's not like that. And so Satan says, well, let's see. And God says, okay. And so God allows Satan to come in and take away everything in Job's life, everything, including his health, his family. He had 10 kids. He lost all of his kids. He lost his business. He lost his property. He lost everything. And so here he is, penniless, and sores all over his body with poor health. And he goes through this whole long ordeal, and it's not just a short time, it's a while that this whole thing lasts. And at the end of the book, when you get to chapter 42, after everything that's happened, Job responds back to God after God has talked with him, and Job responds back, and he says the most amazing thing. He says, God, all of this, everything that's happened, is too wonderful for me. It's too wonderful for me. And I remember contemplating my own situation and thinking to myself, God, will I ever look back on what's happened this past year and say, all of this is too wonderful for me? Because, I mean, how can you look at, you know, the loss of your wife, and it left me with children age 4, 6, and 7 years old as a single dad to raise them on my own, and how could I ever get to the point where I looked up to God and say, God, all this is just too wonderful for me? And it's really hard to see that in the midst of a difficult time. And so as you look through the book of Job, after he loses everything, starting in chapter 4, verses 30, or through chapter 37, Job is asking the question that all of us ask when bad stuff happens. And we all ask the same question, and it's why? Why me? Why now? Why this? Why her? Why? And so from chapter 4 through chapter 37, Job's asking the question, and he's trying to find answers, and he's got these friends who come alongside of him, and they're trying to give him answers. And all of their answers to their why questions are just horrible. They're awful. They make his pain worse, as a matter of fact. They don't make it better. Because the reality is, with a lot of the why questions that we ask, there is no way for us to ever get those questions answered. And what you see in the book of Job is that why is a very paralyzing question, because you can't move on into any future that God would have for you as long as you're stuck on the why question. And when God comes in and he finally does speak, God does actually speak to Job in the book, and that happens in chapters 38, 39, 40, 41. God comes in and he speaks to Job, and what we're expecting God to do is give him the why answer. Job's been crying out for why, and he's been pleading. I mean, and you're looking at Job going, he deserves to know why. And the why is God's up there in heaven bragging on him. And he never knows that. All he knows is he's lost his family, he's lost his health, and he's lost everything that he's loved and everything he's held dear, and he's lost all of his wealth. He's lost everything. And it's almost like, you know, God, if you just tell him why, I mean, if you just tell me that's, if you could tell me something like that's why I'm going to, God, if you were actually up there talking trash to Satan on my behalf and that's why I lost my wife, I could live with that. I'd be okay with that. I'll see her again. That's cool. And if you're going to use me to talk smack to Satan, I'm excited about that. I think that's pretty cool. But I don't know why. And Job didn't know why. And when God shows up, he doesn't answer why. He simply gives him a different perspective. Everything that God says is all about perspective. And he begins and he asks Job's questions, things like, Job, who stops the waves on the shore? Who tells the oceans that they can come this far to the land and no farther? Who is it that determined that we would store up all the snow in Marion, Ohio, and distribute it out to the rest of the world as needed? At least that's what Bobby says. Is where I talk about, where's all the snow stored? He goes, I think it's in my backyard in Marion. You know, who is it that tells the constellations in the sky when to move and where to go, so that ships might navigate them by night? Job, do I ask you for information or help in any of this stuff? No, Job, I don't. I don't ask you for anything. Because you wouldn't be of much help to me, would you? And then he goes on to say, you know what, I've put things in your world that purposely are there so you would understand you can't control everything that happens. You want to control it, and you have all these things, well, if only I had, then that wouldn't have happened kind of issues. Whenever you've lost something, you're always like, what if I'd done this? What if I'd done this? And God's like, whoa, 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 whoa. I have structured the world around you in such that you would figure out you can't control everything. You can't. Look at the alligator. What, are you going to put a leash on that sucker and take it for a walk? You can't. That's what he says. He says, you know, there are animals that you can't control. And back in that series, I talked about, like, Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter. Remember him? When he passed away, okay, he was killed by one of the wild animals that he was out playing with. You know, he's always out there, oh, ferocious, you know, this close to death. And when he died, the entire world had two emotions. One was, oh, I love that guy. I kind of saw it coming. It was really kind of odd. You felt both of those things, right? I mean, you just kind of knew it was going to end that way. No guy who makes a living putting his face in front of cobras and snakes and stingrays is going to live to age 70. You just can't do that. You just can't keep. Eventually, it was going to happen. And when it happened, you're like, no. Yeah, I get it. Because God put animals like that out there, and not even Steve Irwin can control them. Remember all the outrage that came out when he had his daughter, Bindi, and he put his daughter on the back of a crocodile? And the entire world freaked out? Because Steve didn't realize those animals were put there, and as much control as he felt he had over them, we all could still see what he couldn't, and that was, it's still a wild animal that you can't control, and it's not safe to put your daughter on the back of it, and eventually, yeah, it's going to bite you. It's going to sting you. It's going to come back and hurt you. And God's like, listen, I have structured this world in such a way that you might realize and figure out you can't control everything. So you can't go back and say, if only I had. And I've also, there's things in this world that are too big for you to understand. It'd be like asking a rocket scientist exactly how is it they put somebody on the moon. About 5 minutes into the conversation, it would get so technical that you go, okay, yeah, I give up. My dad and my sister are both doctors. They have conversations that I don't even know what they're talking about. You ever seen two doctors? They'll be talking, and they're all this kind of stuff. And they say, so just give it to me straight, doc. We don't know what's wrong with your heart. What did they say to each other? It's an idiopathic cardiomyopathy. That just simply means there's something going on in your heart and we have no idea what it is. But it sounds really cool when they say it like that, right? And that's God. God is on a level up here. His thoughts are, he says, my thoughts are as high as the heavens are above the earth compared to your thoughts. And so, Job, I couldn't explain to you even if I wanted to. So you just have to trust. I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing. You just have to trust that. And we led from there and went into, I gave everybody that Sunday morning a piece of a jigsaw puzzle. It was a 3D jigsaw puzzle. And to this day, I've not shown you what the actual picture is because that's part of the illustration and metaphor. And we looked at Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and there Solomon is going through a passage that all of us are familiar with because of the hippies that sang about it. It says, there's a time and a season for everything. Remember this thing, turn, turn, a time will be a time. He says, there is a time to be born and a time to die. And you think about the contrast of emotions you feel in those two different seasons. And as a pastor, I've actually, several times in my ministry, I've actually gone from one floor and held the hand with somebody as they watch their loved one die, and gone down two floors in the maternity ward and celebrate with a family as they watch a baby come that they never thought would come. And I literally go from one floor to the next, and I can't tell you how many times that happens. And those seasons are both coming in our lives, and we don't have any control over these seasons. And you look at all of them that are coming, there's good ones and bad ones, and a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. There's a time to embrace and even a time to refrain from embracing. And I always think about the pain in this one here. It says there's a time to search and a time to give up that search. When I was in Philadelphia this past week, there was a family that had lost a four-year-old in downtown Philly. And the panic on their face. Can you imagine the feeling that the Natalie Holloway's family felt when they knew it was time to give up the search? I can't comprehend. And these are all the kind of seasons that come into our life. And each one is just like a puzzle piece that we're given. And we look at it and we look at the puzzle piece. We don't have a clue what the picture is. And it's like this jigsaw puzzle of your life, and you got all these pieces out there, and you have no idea how many pieces are even in the puzzle or even what the puzzle is going to make. And you're trying to make sense of it and put it together. And sometimes you put two or three pieces together, and you say, okay, that makes sense there. But you're holding on to puzzle pieces from 10 years ago, and you're still going, God, I still understand what this was for. I don't understand this. And so the writer of Ecclesiastes concludes this section with simply this. He says, what do we gain from all of our toil? What do all these pieces mean? I've seen the burden. I've seen all these pieces that God has put on the human race. And then he makes this conclusion statement. He says, but he's made everything beautiful in his time. And he set eternity in the heart of all of us. So we have an idea that there's something beyond this life. We know there's something more than this life. We know that this life isn't all there is. And then he says, and no one can fathom what God is doing from beginning to end. And so I shared that basically we're given all these puzzle pieces and we're asking why? And God says, you just got to trust me. I'm making something beautiful out of your life, and I'm going to take all of these pieces that you have. And one day we're going to sit together and we're going to put this whole thing together, and you're going to see the beautiful picture that I've made. And it's only then that you'll see your picture becoming a part of the mosaic of all of the life in this 3D image throughout time. And you'll see, just picture a mosaic that is your life. And all these puzzle pieces make up your little piece of that mosaic. And you're going to stand back and you're looking at this and go, wow. Wow. And there is no way right now, here in this time, you could understand how that one little puzzle piece, that one little piece of time and moment in your life that you don't understand fits into this grander scheme. And so you just have to trust that God knows what he's doing. And we came to the conclusion simply this, that Job responds once he gets this sort of insight of perspective and he begins to see things from a different perspective than he has. He says, all of this is too wonderful for me. And it shows us that fulfillment in life and meaning and even joy doesn't have to be connected to any kind of worldly comfort, but can simply come from having a greater perspective of our spiritual reality. It's not connected to our comfort. Our meaning and purpose isn't connected to what's happening in the moment. It's simply understanding a perspective that says, this is eternity, and these are the things that happen in my life. And so if losing my wife at age 37 is just here, and I just keep coming back, and I say all of life is just like preschool. If you've seen a preschooler, how important is it that that preschooler plays with the toy that he wants to play with, right? all of the world is crashing down if he does not get the truck, right? And yet none of you in this room can even remember what that toy was on January 6th, 19, whatever it was for you. You don't have a clue what that toy was. But in the moment, it felt like everything to you. It felt like your whole world. It felt like you were getting the royal shaft in life if you didn't get that toy. And God's saying, listen, your whole life is like that day in preschool compared to all eternity. So just trust me, once you get it from a different perspective, the perspective you have now as an adult looking back at preschool, you're like, come on, it's preschool, really, just shut up, just give them the toy, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But you can't explain that to a four-year-old any more than God can explain to you a tragedy that comes in your life without you having a perspective of all eternity. And so we went through and kind of unpacked all of that and how in hindsight we'll look back and see that God is at work in our lives, and what if we could live in the moment with the understanding that God is at work, and he is, as that song said, he's working all things for our good. Everything that happened in 2013, all of the good and all of the bad, he's going to work all of that for good. Everything that's, you know, things that are going to come in 2014, there's going to be good things you experience this year because of some of the bad things that happened last year. And he says, I can do that. Only I have the power to do that. You got to trust me in that. So if they're like really restless, we do have a room over there if you want to take them over there. It's up to you. Whatever. Moving on. And the next series after that was all about coming home. And we kicked that off on Easter Sunday through Luke chapter 15. And so here's a little clip from we used the bumper video for that. There's something I never even got into in that series is that the video clips from that bumper were actually taken from a real-life true documentary story. That kid in the video and that dad, this really happened with him. That kid decided he wanted to run away from home, and he ran away to New York City. And his father, through talking to the kid's friends, found out that his son may be in New York City. Didn't know, but may be where we went. They lived in Orlando, Florida. And so the dad and a friend of his drove all night to New York City to look for their son. I mean, imagine what a crazy errand that would be. So they went to Times Square. I was just actually in Times Square last week, and all I could think about was that story. You know, Times Square, I mean, when I was there was a million people there. Only on any given day, there's, you know, 50 to 100,000 people that can be there. And imagine going to look for one person in all of New York City. And so he and his buddy just went into Times Square, got on either side of the street, and within about an hour, they ended up finding his son at the McDonald's in Times Square. I mean, just an amazing, incredible story. And that's really kind of encapsulates the heart of a father, is when the son goes away, the heart of the father just wants him to come back in. And Jesus tells a story that most of us kind of know is referred to as the prodigal son. But Jesus just simply says it's a story about two brothers. And in this series, Come Home, we looked at each person in the story. We looked at the heart of the father. We looked at the heart of the son that went off on this path of self-discovery and said, I'm going to figure out what there is in life to know, and I can't do that here in my dad's house, so I'm going to go off, and I'm just going to go on this path of self-discovery, and whatever feels good, I'm going to do it. Then you have an older brother who decides, you know, really meaning and purpose and fulfillment of life really comes from doing the right thing, and so he tries to pursue that same sense of worth and value in life through a pursuit of moral conformity. But neither brother, neither the older brother or the younger brother, pursue a genuine relationship with the father. And it leaves both of them outside of the house. And Jesus is telling the story to two groups of people. He's telling the story to one group of people who stand there listening to him are people who are very far from God. They know they're far from God. They know they're all living the prodigal life. And many of you right now are in that prodigal life era of your life. Many of you have been, I mean, almost all of us have been in that prodigal life journey at some point where we went off and we did a bunch of dumb things. But he's also talking to a crowd there as well. Other people are listening to him there who are very, very religious, very, very moral, very, very upright. They think they've got a great relationship with God simply because they're doing all the right do's and they're not doing any of the don'ts. And Jesus is trying to communicate to them, both of you in this group, just like both of these sons are not pursuing a relationship with the Father, so it leaves you alienated. And we talked about how the heart of the Father always wants you to come back home. Whether you're the older brother or the younger brother, the father goes out to meet both brothers outside the house and invite them to come back in. And so we also learn in that series that every time that Jesus talks about God, he refers to him as Father. A.W. Tozer once famously said, what comes to your mind when you think about God is the most important thing about us. So what you think about when you think about God is the most important thing about you, because we tend to, by secret law of the soul, move towards our mental image of God. So what you think about when you think about God is one of the most important things about your life, because we tend to move towards that secret image of the soul, influenced by what we think about God. And the reason why is because everybody, every human on the face of the earth, doesn't matter where you live, doesn't matter where you grew up, doesn't matter where you're born, India, China, Pakistan, it doesn't matter, America, everybody has at least three questions of the human soul that they have to have an answer to. It doesn't matter where you are, they're universal questions of life, universal questions of humanity. And that's, where did I come from? Why am I here? What happens after I die? I mean, the reason why there is over 90% of the globe believes in a God of some form is because those questions are written on the human soul. And they're questions that can't be answered by anything under the sun. Anything you experience in life can't answer where you came from. You can try, but even science at some point goes, we don't know. What caused the first cause? We don't know. Where did all the matter come from that created all the other matter? We don't know. How did everything get here on this planet in the perfect order in the right place? We don't know. So even there, you know, we dead ends in science. Why am I here? One of my favorite quotes we talked about that back last year was a quote by Richard Dawkins. He was a very famed atheist. He says, you know, science has now answered every question that religion has attempted to answer, except for a few trivial matters like meaning and purpose in life. Did you just say that one question that is trivial, that one foundational question everybody has to have an answer to, or else we don't have a hope or reason for living? I mean, if we don't know why we're here, what our purpose is, studies have shown over and over and over again, it leads to despair. And then last, of course, what happens after I die? And God informs the answer to every one of those questions, and what you think about when you think about God will inform how you answer each of those questions, and how you answer each of those questions will determine the moral path that you take. It'll determine the emotional path you take in life. It'll shape what your values are in life. And so Tozer says, what you think about when you think about God, because it's going to shape the answers to the most foundational questions of life, is a very, very important thing. And so Jesus, in this parable, come home, he says, listen, I want you to think about, when you think about God, I want you to think about a loving father. Now, if you don't have a good father example, then don't think about that father. Think about the kind of father you know your father should have been, or the kind of father you would want to be. That's what you should think about when you think about God, a loving father. And so we spent a week in each of this series, 1 week on each character in the story, the father, the younger brother, the older brother. But then we talked about the most important person in the story isn't the father, and it isn't the older brother, and it isn't the younger brother. The most important person in the story in Luke chapter 15 is the one who's telling it. You see, Jesus is the one who's telling it, and Jesus is telling both these brothers who've blown it and messed up. He says, both of you are invited back in the house. And the father wants both of you back in the house. At some point, you know, both go, but how could I be accepted back in after what I've done? Well, I mentioned earlier that every time Jesus referred to God, he always called him Father. Every time but one. And that was when he was on the cross paying for our sins. And there he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And what Jesus is doing in that moment, he is giving you and me his rightful place in the house as a son, as a worthy son who has lived up to all the Father's expectations and has a relationship with the Father. And he's giving every one of us his place in the Father's house. And he is taking on for himself everything that we deserve. Everything the younger brother and the older brother deserve, he's taking on at the cross. So that's why he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Jesus is not welcomed into the Father's house in that moment. And said he goes to the grave. And then he comes out of it and conquers death. That's a cool story, but that's a different story. And so we looked at that in the Come Home series. So no matter what you've done, no matter what you've become, whether you're trying to find meaning and purpose in life by being a very good person and being very religious, or whether you've blown it and gone down the prodigal road, Jesus wants you to know, I want to give you my rightful place in the house. And the Father wants to welcome you in. And that was the series, Come Home. We also talked in there also, if you have a prodigal child, there's also a message in there for you, how to parent a prodigal child. That was sort of a side message in that series. And then after that, we moved to Mother's Day, and we talked about how is it that we can fill up people's love tank with a series called A Heart Full of Love. Father's Day, and we looked at a lot of the stuff out of Gary Chapman's several books called The Five Love Languages. And we talked about how in the very first message of that series, I showed a clip from Grease, just so that annoying song would stick in your head. And just the idea was, is that there's any time there's two people that are in relationship with each other, there's going to be friction. It doesn't matter if it's a marriage relationship, parent-child relationship, co-working relationship. There's always friction whenever two people come in contact with each other. And what we see in Scripture and in life is that love is like the grease in those relationships. Where there is no love, there's just friction and tension. But where love abounds, it covers a multitude of sins. Where love abounds, it's like it just provides the grease for a relationship. And where there is no love, there's going to be difficulty in the relationship. And also in that series, one of the hallmark parts of it, it wasn't just enough to feel love for someone. It wasn't just enough to actually love someone. What you actually needed to do in there, if you're really gonna love someone and provide that grease in the relationship, is you have to love them in such a way that they feel loved. And we talked about it, you know, there's sometimes we feel love for somebody else, but they don't feel loved by us. And so this whole series was all about trying to find ways to communicate love to someone. We started off, there's five love languages: affirming words, physical touch, acts of service, the giving of gifts, and spending quality time. And the very first week, we kicked it off with affirming words, which are the easiest and most powerful, I think, of the love languages. And the reason why I say it's the most powerful of the five love languages is because of something that Charles Horton Cooley found in 1902. He's a sociologist, and he came up with this idea or concept called the looking glass self. And what it basically is, this theory, this idea, is simply this, is that you form your view of yourself by whatever the most important person in your life says about you. You form your self-image about yourself by whatever the most important person in your life says about you. So if you're a child and the most important person in your life is your parents, what they say about you will define how you see yourself. And so what you label your kids at, if you're always telling your kids that they're irresponsible and good for nothing, how do you think they're going to see themselves? As irresponsible and good for nothing. If you tell your kids that they are loved by you and loved by God, and they are created for special things, and God has great plans for them, and they can, you know, you always build them up, they're going to be built up. And the same way in marriages, and if the most important person in your life is the person that you're married to, what they say about you will shape how you view yourself. And all of us have seen the outcomes of this in good marriages and in bad marriages. When people are always putting us down, eventually we begin to believe it. I think it was the Pretty Woman line. People tell you something long enough, you begin to believe it. How many of y'all remember that line? Anyone? Anyone? Okay, yeah. All right, some of y'all get the wave back machines. All right. And so we become whatever the most important person says we are. And then we also looked in there about how physical touch, that touch confirms the words that we speak. When we actually reach out and give someone a hug, we can say we love them or we can say we want to help them, but it was until we go out and actually do that and actually reach out and give them that hug, it confirms the words. It's a confirmation of the things that we're saying. And then acts of service, if you remember, that was a clip I used from the movie The Breakup, and there's a great line in there where she's like, "Will you help me with the dishes?" And he's like, "I don't want to." She's like, "But I want you to want to do the dishes." And he's like, "Who would want to do dishes?" She's like, "Well, you would if you loved me." He's like, "I love you, but what does that have to do with dishes?" She's like, "Everything." And it's true. When we perform acts of service and we humble ourselves and love somebody to serve them, it shows them love and it communicates love, and we feel loved when people do those things. And then Bobby shared about gifts and how it's the thought that counts behind the gifts. It's not the price. It's just the fact that when we were out somewhere, we were thinking about them. When I was in New York this past week, I bought my kids the very same gift that my parents bought me when they went to New York when I was that age. These little like kimono robes so they can play karate all over the house. They had a great time with it. Sorry, it's just fun. And then lastly, spending quality time. That's just being there and giving that undevoted time. Or undevoted? Is that the right word? Yeah, okay. Is that word? Undevoted? What? Undivided time. Devoted time, undivided. Yes. You cannot combine the two. All right. At least y'all know what I'm trying. Listen to what I think, not what I say. And so that's a wonderful series. And if you have any friction in relationships, I would highly encourage you just to go back on the internet, either yourself or with the person in your life, and just re-listen to some of the messages from that series about a heart full of love. And then after that, we went into the summer months, and I'm not going to preview this one, because the summer months, we looked at a series called Epic, and they were just stories from the Old Testament that were just too good not to know. And there was really no running theme other than the fact these are just good stories that probably will never come up in any other sermon series, but I really want you to know them. And so they were just really good one-and-done kind of messages. I did some of them. I think James did one. Bobby did a couple of them. And we just shared some of our favorite stories. And so if you want to go back and listen to those, you can find that on the internet. And then when we came back into the school year, we hit a series called Refresh. In case you're wondering, yes, I do talk fast in this series because I'm trying to get it 52 weeks of sermons into 30 minutes or less. So I'm just pumping in caffeine in between every break, right? So the Refresh series. The concept of this whole series, if you've ever been looking at your phone or on a computer, and you're looking at something that should be information that's being updated, whether it be a stock report or a Facebook page, and you're looking at it, nothing's changing, and you kind of have to hit the refresh button and kind of read new things and kind of get new information coming in. And we talked about this kind of a metaphor in our spiritual life, how oftentimes we get very stagnant and stale in our relationship with God, and we don't really move. We get to a certain point, we just quit growing anymore. And we looked at how even in Jesus' own life, that Jesus had to grow in wisdom and stature in his relationship with God. And if Jesus had to always be growing, then what's that say for us? We never get to a point in our walk with God where we say, you know, I've arrived. There's nothing else for me to know about God. I know it all. There's always more to know, and there's always a deeper level to go with God. And it's very easy for us to just get to a point where our relationship with God or our testimony about God looks more like a Wikipedia page than a Twitter post. And God's saying, listen, I want you to be able to tweet or Facebook post what I'm doing in your life every day. I want to have that kind of relationship with you. Not like there's this article about one thing that God did back when you were, you know, in your teens or 20s and God moved amazingly and remember, look at that, remember, look at that, remember, look at that. No, God wants to always be afresh and alive. And in this thing, we talked about how one thing that often happens that leads to stagnancy in our relationship with God is we get to the point where we kind of move God away from a relationship that we have with him to just kind of a being or an entity. And for some of us, that's maybe the sum total of our entire relationship with God. And it's especially true for those who came to faith or believe they came to faith through a very intellectual route. Like they had some questions that they had to sort out, like about creation or about biology or evolution or something like that, or maybe some questions about the Bible and the historicity of it. And so they came to God and they finally looked at all the evidence and said, yeah, I believe there is a God. And we talked about how it's one thing to believe in God as a concept. It's another thing to know God and have a relationship with him. Because as long as God is a concept, you can shape that however you want. God as a concept is lighter than you, but God as who he is, as a real being, is not somebody you can change or manipulate. And we talked in that series about there were 10 lepers who all came to God and had a life-changing encounter with Jesus. Jesus healed them of their leprosy. Their life would forever be changed because of their encounter with Jesus. But they didn't have a profound life soul change, an eternal change in their life. It was just the one guy who comes back to Jesus and says, Jesus, you healed me, and I want to have a relationship with you. And that's the guy, it says, who is saved. That's the guy whose life is never the same anymore. The other guys had a very life-altering experience with God, but not a life-changing experience like the one who came back. And so for many of us, we settle for a life-alter experiencing with God because we just want him to kind of change and work on a few things. We come to church to kind of get a few things lined up in our life or in our marriage or in our job, and then we kind of want to go back out and do our own thing. And God, for who he is, doesn't allow us that luxury. If you really get to know the one true God, it's like a freight train that hits you, and you're never the same ever again. We asked 5 questions in that about your life as a Christian. It says, you know, if you really are a Christian, then there should be some answers to these 5 questions. Number one is, when was the moment you gave your life to Jesus? I mean, you don't just kind of drift into a relationship. At some point, you say, I'm all in. And that's the way it is in any relationship. You know, whether it be a marriage relationship or a business relationship, at some point, you say, I'm all in. And so if you have a relationship with God, this whole idea of, well, I've always been a Christian since I was born. No, you haven't. If you've always been a Christian since you were born, then you've never really jumped in with both feet. And so you should have an answer to the question, when was the moment that you gave your life to Jesus and jumped in with both feet? Next question was it your decision or was it your parents' decision? Was it your decision to follow after God or was it something that you just did because your parents wanted you to do it? Does it amaze you that you've been forgiven? Are you amazed at the fact that God has forgiven you? I mean, if you're not amazed at what he's done in your life, then I don't think you really have a relationship with God. Because if you know God, then you know just how sinful you are and how bad you've blown and how much like a prodigal child you really are. And you look at God and you say, there is no way God could ever love me after what I've done. And when you realize that he does and he gave up his place in the Father's house for you, you're amazed by it all. And also we ask another question is, do I experience conviction when I sin? You know, Christians aren't people who never sin anymore. They're just people that when they do sin, there's that conviction, there's that nagging of the soul, that spirit within them that just says, this isn't right, this isn't right, this isn't right, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be going here. There's something in your soul that's crying out to you. That's why the pointed question sometimes can come up when you're headed down a wrong path. It's just simple question. Is there anything in you that's telling you, you're going in a bad direction right now? Is there anything in you that's saying, this is not a good decision, this is not a good place to be going? And if there is, you got to recognize that's the Holy Spirit in your life because you invited him into your life. You need to listen to that. And then lastly, am I really any different? Has there really been any change in my life? Can I look back and say, this is how I was, but this is how I now am? And then sort of building off of that, we looked at how God doesn't allow you to leave him as a concept because he came to earth. And that's why the most pivotal question that anybody can be asked is, who was Jesus? Who was Jesus? You can argue all day about all these different things, but at the end of the day, you have to ask the question, who was Jesus? Is he who he said he was? Was he really God who came down to earth or not? Because if he is, then there isn't just this kind of random cosmic concept of God. God's a real person. And he wants you to have a relationship with you. And Christianity was never about a philosophy. It was always about a person. It was about a relationship with a person. And we've been saying over and over again all year this past year that this life is nothing more. The trials you face in life, the joys you face in life, the experiences you face in life, everything in life is nothing more than providing you an opportunity to begin a relationship with God, grow in a relationship with God, and the kind of relationship that you'll want to enjoy forever. In that Refresh series, we said, you know, if it's become anything else than that, then get back to what it's supposed to be, is a relationship with God. I can't underestimate how important that is. And I know I'm... I hate the clock. I got one more series to go, but I got something really... You know, I'll get 1 minute on this. I'm asked a lot of questions theologically. That's a good thing. People bring me theological questions. They're why questions. And why would God do it like this? And this doesn't make any sense. Why doesn't God just tell us what he wants from us? Why doesn't God just show all this? Why leave it a mystery? How come the Bible just doesn't read more like bullet point list? Why is it all these stories and everything else? Everything in there. The answer to everything is the answer of love. And it's there. We see it. We just ignore it when we get bogged down in these theological questions. Jesus was asked, in a very complex, situation, 613 commandments. Jesus, which one is the most important? Love God. Why do trials come in our life? Because it's an opportunity for us to show that we love God more than anything else. Everything is always about loving God. And love is very complex, is it not? Very, very complex. And if God were just to give you a list and say, Here's all the things I want you to do. It'd be easy to do those things, but not love God. And if God were, if it were all about accomplishing something, then you could accomplish a lot of things, but not love God. But it's all about loving God. From beginning to end, it's all about a loving relationship with him. And was anybody out in San Jose or in Atlanta a few months ago? Anyone? Well, somebody from each of those two places won $314 million. Largest lottery winning jackpot ever. And I thought about this. As a single guy, if I were to win a $314 million lottery, how would I ever know from that point forward that anybody really loved me for me? Really? How would you ever know if you had $314 million in the bank? How would you ever know? Like, how does Mark Zuckerberg know that girl really loves him? It's almost impossible to tell. I don't even think the person who loves him would even know whether or not it's for the money or for the person. You think about how much greater wealth and power does God have? And if he didn't do things the way that he did, he would never know whether or not you really loved him or not. Because it'd be very easy to love God just for the things he could do for us. So all of that was kind of summarized in the Refresh series. And then we finished out the year with a series called Unchristian. So for me, the funniest thing about that whole series was I never got to the theme verse of the whole series. There are so many passages in Scripture that deal with this issue of unchristian that I never got to the Acts chapter 10, verse 15 verse. I never even got there in the series. There was just so much stuff. Basically, we talked about how this label unchristian is a label that is often used to manipulate us to do whatever somebody wants us to do. For instance, they ask you for money, and when you tell them no, they say, oh, well, I thought you were a Christian. They try to dump their responsibilities in life on you and get you to do all the things that they're responsible for doing. And when you say, no, I won't do it, and you put up that boundary line, they look at you and say, well, I thought you were a Christian. And we found in that series that we weren't the first people to be accused of being unchristian. Jesus was often accused of being unchristian or unmessiah-like or ungodly-like. And Jesus never allowed anybody to manipulate him. He knew who he was. He knew what God had asked him to do. And he refused to be manipulated. And so when you know who you are and what God has called you to do, you're able to set up boundary lines in your life and not be manipulated by somebody who wants to say that you're unchristian because you don't do what they want them to do. And one of the memorable messages from that series was from Galatians 6, verse 2. It says, carry each other's burdens, and this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. And if anyone thinks they're something when they're not, they deceive themselves. Each one should test their own actions so they can take pride themselves without comparing them to anyone else. For each one should carry their own load. And so there was that contrast there between carry one another's burdens and carry your own load. And we talked about the load that you're supposed to carry is kind of like what's in your backpack, and everybody's got a backpack, and these are your responsibilities in life, things that you need to take care of. But sometimes life overwhelms you, and there's things that are, you know, unique circumstances, and at those points in time, you need somebody to come alongside of you. And that's like a big old trunk you got to carry around, and you need people to come around. And we have problems in life when other people try to make their backpack our trunk, right? And so we need to be able to separate those things out. And the whole series, I just got to conclude with this. The whole series was based on a passage out of Acts chapter 10, verse 15, where God reveals to Peter, he says, listen, it's okay to eat anything now. I mean, I've made all these things clean. And Peter says in response, oh, no. I would never dishonor you by eating those things. God's like, I just told you it was okay. It's like, no, but I wouldn't want to offend you by doing it. And he's like, whoa. And God comes in, and the theme verse was, don't call anything unclean that I have made clean. Like, Peter's looking at it saying, well, if I were to eat that stuff, that'd be unchristian. He's like, no, don't call something unchristian that I have said is Christian, that is right, that is okay. And you've got to really know what is it God's word says to keep yourself from being manipulated and find ways to honor God in your life. And then, of course, we finished out the series with, the year with a Christmas series on faith, hope, and love. And I think 2013 was a pretty good year. And for me, it was a long year. It's hard for me to even remember my mental state a year ago and coming back. For me, it seems like such a long, long time ago, the things that, you know, I was going through back then. And I thank you guys for everything you've done for me in my life. And my hope is that, like I have learned from these lessons, that you will have learned from them too, that 2014 will be a much better year, a much different year because of the time you spent in God's Word, because of the time you spent here. And Jesus gives this story at the end of one of his sermons. He says, there was two men who built a house. One built it on a rock and one built it on sand. And the difference between the two is the one who built his house on a rock is the one who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice. But the one who builds a house on sand that washes away is the one who hears these words of mine and doesn't put them into practice. And so the question is, if you're planning on spending the next 52 weeks of the year in church every week, will you apply the stuff and build your house on the things that we talk about in here? Or will you just say, you know, that was a good message, I'm going to go out and do my own thing? Will you go with me to close in prayer? Father, as I look back and think over this past year, it's been a good year. There's been some highs and there's been some lows, but we're still here. There's still things that in many of our lives that are unresolved. There's things that are uncertainties in 2014. And there's things that we're asking the why questions about right now. Help us gain your perspective. Just knowing that in 100 years from now, nothing that we're worried about right now is even going to matter. As we sung earlier that you work all things for our good. All things. Everything good that happened in 2013, you're going to use for our good. And everything bad that happened in 2013, you're going to use for our good this coming year. And everything that will come our way, your word says you'll use all of it for our good. So may we begin this year in trust and in faith. And just say, Lord, bring it on. Whatever this year has, bring it on. Because I trust you. And in Jesus' name, amen.